I'm Brian Hanna. Thanks for joining me for Better Than Monkeys, a production of WQLN.
The following program contains content which may not be suitable for all audiences. Viewer discretion is advised.
Hello, everybody. It's Brian Hanna, the host of Better Than Monkeys here on WQLN NPR. And I just want to throw out a little disclaimer before this episode begins. We're going to be talking about the funeral business. Some things could be a little unpleasant to certain listeners. So just take that into account. And I hope you enjoy this special behind the scenes look at the funeral business on Better Than Monkeys. What is it that makes us as humans different? Even, shall I say, better than monkeys? Hello, everybody. I guess probably not much these days. I'm Brian Hanna. Thanks for joining me for Better Than Monkeys here on WQLN NPR. Well, Charlie Darwin said that humans and monkeys both started in the same tree. At some point, monkeys continued eating bananas and swinging from vines, and humans continued along the path of evolution. We now shave, we go to work, we pay mortgages. But perhaps the thing that makes us most human, and different from monkeys, is our desire to build a world around us, to revel in the sciences. Another major difference is the way we grieve when we lose a loved one. We've implemented a relatively complex set of rituals which fall into place after the death of a family member or a friend. From viewings to religious services, from embalming to burial to cremation, it's a lot to deal with in a time of grief, and it takes a special kind of person, an unsung hero of sorts, to help us navigate these difficult times. Funeral directors and their staffs work odd hours, deal with grief-stricken families, and well, they also deal with aspects of death and dying that you or I can't even begin to imagine. Today on Better Than Monkeys, we're going to go behind the scenes of the funeral business. From the importance of pre-planning, to embalming, to cremation, to really unusual requests, we're going to try to cover it all with our special guests, Nancy Duskus and Barbara Terizzi from Duskus Funeral Homes, as we open the casket on the world of mortuary sciences. Nancy and Barbara joining us here for this episode of Better Than Monkeys. And, you know, some of the staff here at WQLN, we're sitting around talking about interesting topics. And one of the staff members here at WQLN NPR is a fan of a podcast called Ask a Mortician. And we thought, you know, who gets to talk to morticians here? We talk to business leaders all over Erie, all over the radio, all the time. But we never get to really ask morticians and funeral directors the questions we really want to know. So we can dive right into it. Are dead bodies gross? No, we'll talk about that in a few minutes. So why don't we start with Nancy? Because Nancy, you handle the business end of the funeral business. Often now, pre-planning is a big deal. So people want to get ready so they don't have to deal with the business end of a funeral when the time comes. So what are your suggestions for somebody who's, you know, interested from a pre-planning standpoint? Is that a good idea?
We think it's an excellent idea for many reasons. First of all, there's a lot of people who have no family to be responsible for themselves down the road. So if they pre-plan, we know that their wishes are taken care of. Right. We've had several situations that the person passes away, they cannot find any family members to step up and be responsible. And, you know, if you have a family member step up down the road and say, this is not what my relative wanted, you know, it's going to be a precarious situation. So we really think it's important for a person to be responsible for themselves. There are a lot of couples who choose to pre-plan. They have family, they have assets, but they just want to take that pressure off of their kids. We have other families who actually are going into a nursing home, so they have to have a spend-down mode so they can protect some of their assets. We also have other people who they're not going into a nursing home, but they want to go under assistance, like the medical access card. And when you go under that, you're only limited to how much money you're allowed to have. So they pre-plan some money that way. And the interesting thing about pre-planning is the couples don't always agree. You know, we have some couples, one wants to have a full viewing, full burial. The other spouse wants to have a cremation. With or without viewing, you can have it. Right. But they don't have to agree. They oftentimes disagree. But we try to get them to really understand what each other wants and also what's best for the family. You know, we have a lot of families that come in and they're not sure what they want. And I'll say, what do your kids want? They say, well, we don't care. We're going to be dead. So we say, what do you think your kids want? And they come back and they change their opinions and they change the way that they've handled things because they have talked to the kids.
So how about really strange requests? I'm a musician. Say I want a 12-piece band playing at my funeral. Is that the kind of thing they can accommodate?
We actually had one a few years back that we had a blues band that came in, you know, like the jazz one from New Orleans, that type of music. We had that one there. And so we get some unique requests, not all the time, but the ones that we get, we try to honor.
What's the most unique request?
Well, probably not a hearse per se, but we've had people on like a carriage type thing come in, or they've had a Civil War reenactment type person has come in on a carriage with horses. So that's probably been the most unique, bringing the horses out and taking them on the gravesite.
When somebody decides that they want to take advantage of having their final, I don't know, display is probably the wrong word.
Their final
ceremony at your funeral home. Say they have an unusual request. Maybe they want to be displayed isn't the right word. Presented.
Laid out.
Laid out.
Yeah.
Sitting on the back of a motorcycle or standing. Or do you get those kind of requests?
We get them teasingly. People like want to sleep on their side or whatever, and we jokingly with them, but no one has really been seriously following through with it.
Right.
Not that it hasn't been done in some areas. Probably the least that you can really do is put someone in a recliner chair, because after that you really can't hold a person up.
Right.
But what I was thinking about then when we were talking about this prior to was, if you go to other third world countries, I have a friend that just came back as a missionary from Ghana, and they actually do those type of presentations all the time. So after the person passes away and they do the prep work, they have what they call a staging. And they have the person up in their chairs. They have everything that they've done that's been part of their life work, like if they're a farmer or something, that's up there on the staging thing with them. So we've seen it more often in African countries, third world countries, than we do here. You know, there's been a couple through the doors, but most of it is teasing, and fortunately we haven't been too bizarre yet,
at least not in Erie.
Yeah.
When a family comes to you for a service, do they tend to stay with the funeral home for all of their family needs?
99.9% of the time,
yes. So return business, so to speak?
Yes, it is, yeah. So. You try to win their trust, and I guess when my dad was first starting out in business and he got to know people and didn't really have a strong core of people when he first came back and opened up. We had talked about it once, that he was really pleased to know that people trusted him enough that they would drive by another funeral home to come to him. So you still have families doing that, which is a blessing. Most of the time, they do stay with the ones that are tried and true, in a sense, with their family funerals, yeah.
Well, do you actually live at the residence? Is their family there 24/7?
I was at the funeral home until 10 years ago, born and raised from crib room on up. We were all part of it. We played in the casket room. We played hide and seek. You know, around there, we had, you know, friends over for sleepovers. We still have someone that lives over the business at our one location, but that's kind of a thing where a lot of the families now are just establishing out in private homes, so you don't see that often. But I was one of those rare breeds that was born and bred and raised there my whole life.
Ghosts. You know, you've both, Barbara and Nancy, been in the funeral business for a while now. Does it increase with time your belief in afterlife? Is that something that you don't really think about? Do you have experiences where you're like, well, who knows?
Yeah. I'll let Barbara answer that first, and then I'll answer my little kid story.
Okay. As far as ghosts?
As far as ghosts
Or afterlife, even.
Well, that's never been an issue to me. It's never spooked me out. We know once we have the body back to the funeral home that their spirit is gone. And I've never heard any noises at night, you know, at 2 o'clock in the morning, things like that. So I've never really been spooked out by ghosts per se, maybe by a drunk walking by as I'm pulling into the funeral home at 2 in the morning. But as far as working with the bodies, that's never.
Well, okay. I've had one little story I can tell. When I was young growing up, and I was locking up the building by myself, and I was the only person in the building, and I heard sobbing down by the casket. And that was like, and I was the only person in the building with that person. And I really thought, oh my gosh, okay, here's my first ghost coming through the door. But what it ended up being is the festival was going on across the street at St. James. And behind our brick wall, down where the casket was, there was a guy and a girl that had a fight. So he was trying to console her and she was sobbing, but it was outside. But it came through the building all the way to the front of the room. So when I finally went around and figured out what was going on, I was okay with that. But let me tell you, for a minute there, I thought, you know. And then a couple things, too, I think that a couple younger generations, one experience that happened even before I was licensed, the one thing about the bodies is that even though the person dies, their cells may live in a body for up to 12 hours. And one of the times I know my dad was prepping a person with one of the other staff, and the arm shot up. And but not my dad, but the other guy went like flying out of the room because he thought, oh my gosh. So, you know, things like that can happen with the bodies with cell life, but it doesn't happen a lot.
I think if you let your mind wander, anything can happen while you're there alone.
Yeah. I don't know now Barb has young kids, and I don't know if it's ever happened to them going into the funeral homes yet. But when we were kids too and brought our friends in, and we would say, oh, come see this person, and we take them in and we look at the person. All of a sudden, like a whole group of us little kids at the same time would think that the chest is going up and down. Mm-hmm. And we'd scream and we go running out of the room. So
you stare at it long enough, it's going to move.
It's going to move, right? Exactly.
You're listening to Better Than Monkeys, a production of WQLN NPR. We're digging deep into the world of mortuary sciences here on Better Than Monkeys. I'm Brian Hanna. Nancy Duskus and Barbara Terizzi of the Duskus Funeral Homes are our special guests today on Better Than Monkeys.
So when you meet people for the first time and they ask you what you do for a living,
yes.
We were just talking about that before we started, Barb. How do you approach that? Do people come out with a joke right away because they feel uneasy, or do they start asking you questions about
your
profession?
I tell them that I'm a funeral director, they say, oh, what do you do? I said, well, I'm a funeral director. Well, you don't touch the bodies, do you? I said, I absolutely do. That's part of being a funeral director, you know? And then it just rolls on from there, question after question after question. So
do they get creeped out, or they seem generally interested? Or
they're
is it a little mix?
They're more than shocked. It's usually shocked that they always say, you don't look like a funeral director. And I said, well, thank you.
What does a funeral director look like?
But I said, thank you, because I don't look like one. So I guess that's a good thing. I don't know.
But, well, as a funeral director who does have to touch bodies, you're responsible for embalming, I would assume.
Yes.
And that's one of those words. We all know the word. We're not 100% sure what that word means.
Right.
You know, it's like all the blood comes out. You put more fluids in there. That's about where our knowledge as lay people comes from. But what is exactly involved in embalming? Now, we're talking a standard somebody dies at their home. Somebody picks them up, brings them to your funeral parlor. Now you take over.
Well, the first step we do is we place the body on the table, disinfect the body. We have chemical spray that we put on the body to disinfect it. Then we put the body on boards on the table, set the head and the arms, set the features. We do close the mouth, close the eyes. We do try and clean all the orifices first before we close. And then once we have all the features set, we make an incision, generally in the neck, and raise the artery and vein there. Now, with the artery, we pump fluid, embalming fluid, in, and it forces the blood out of the vein. So once you know that blood has circulated and the fluid is throughout the body, and there's other ways to tell also that the fingertips clear out. You could see the color change because most of the time the chemicals we use are tinted and colored so we can make sure every part of the body is getting fluid.
So what happens if you don't get all the fluid out?
Well, you never know if you do or don't. So
you can tell by the texture of the skin if it's dry enough. What we use is a formaldehyde agent, and it's a drying agent. So like a lot of times if I have kids come through on a tour, I say, you know, look at your leather shoes. You know, formaldehyde is used on that as a drying agent. So the intent of the preservation that we do, number one, it does kill a lot of bacteria and disease, but it also is a drying agent. So even though you may not get 100% of the fluid out, you know by the touch of the body that it's dry enough that you can put it out in the public so that the body is not going to start breaking down or decaying on us. And that's the big key, is you don't want it to start breaking down.
How long do you have from the time you embalm it till we really need to make sure that this person's interred or cremated? Or
we try not to push more than 3 weeks or so. I mean, not that you can't go way, way out, but there's a lot of variables that are involved in a person. Like one of our hardest things that we fight really is fluid retention. You get someone who goes into a hospital that's having organ failure and shutdown. They just start pumping fluid in them at the hospital to keep them alive. Well, then that puffs the body. You got a ton of fluid in it. And then it's our job to try to we can't really always bring the swelling down, but you try to get as much fluid out so that the chemicals don't start breaking down with the mixture of the fluid in the water. Those are harder ones to try to preserve, you know, months out. But, you know, we'll go 2-3 weeks out 100% confident, and not that you can't keep it a lot longer, but with all the variables involved in trying to keep a person alive at the hospital, you know, you just want to make sure that, you know, it's good.
And what kind of situation would it be that you would need to keep somebody around for 2 or 3 weeks?
Well, I had
family out of town, or they
have
to transport?
Yeah, most of the time, yeah.
I actually had one years ago that the person, the gentleman was in the hospital, or excuse me, the gentleman was in the nursing home, an elderly gentleman, and his brother and sister-in-law convinced his elderly wife to go on a trip with them to Hawaii. They just left. And so they decided to complete the trip, and then 3 weeks later come back, and then we went into the funeral. So it's most of the time people are overseas and trying to get back.
Right. Yeah. Now, you said close the orifices. Is this like a glue staple stitching, or is this like just push their mouth closed and
the
it stays there?
The mouth, typically you have to suture, or we use what are called needle injectors. Mm-hmm. So it's... it holds the mouth closed, so it's not, you know, you walk in and the mouth's dropped open and flies going around and all that stuff. But then sometimes we do have to glue either the eyes or the lips to make a closure so the eyes don't open up, you know, when you're coming for visitation.
Doesn't happen every time, but you just kind of work with
everybody's different.
Yeah.
Right.
And I also tell kids a lot of times when we do this, the needles or the metal to kind of hold the mouth. It's like putting dentures in. You know, you just you put metal in there just enough to just
clip
enough
it together.
Clip
just
it together.
Clip together. So what about eyeballs? Do you have to do anything magical to keep? Because eyes are all fluid practically, right? So I'd assume they would sink and kind of get empty.
Sometimes you just a little piece of tissue will hold it. Sometimes just a little piece of cold cream will hold it. Sometimes it's like an eye cap, like a contact. So, again, it depends.
It's a hard plastic, so it will hold the form of the eye. Because they do dehydrate a lot faster than everything else.
Right. So the first time you had to do any of this, this would be Barb we're talking to, you go to school for this, obviously.
Correct.
It's like 2 to 4 years, or is it a four-year degree, or how
does
that
work? Well, I
went
to Gannon for 3 years, and then I went to mortuary school, and it's 12 months. And that's when you do all the hands-on training with embalming and cosmetics and reconstructive art and all that.
Can you just go right to mortuary school, or do you have to have like a undergrad degree?
You can actually go right to mortuary school. Pittsburgh does have a program where I've had kids in my class that were right out of high school in mortuary school. But then you go 18 months, and then you go to – they have a community college where you'd have to do another 2 years to get your associate's degree.
Yeah, so Pennsylvania does require at least 2 years of college.
Right.
Mortuary school, and then a year of an internship. But however you go into it, you have to end up with 2 years of college.
So have you heard stories of people who go into the mortuary sciences and just, this isn't going
to
work?
Yes. My first day of mortuary school, the guys came up to me and said, you're not going to last a week once you start embalming, which I had already been working at a funeral home, so I already knew everything going into it. But a lot of people do drop out once you get on the hands-on with it.
The hands-on part. Now, the hands-on part is the part that makes everybody a little squeamish, but practically everybody goes through that unless there's some kind of extenuating circumstances. At these days, it's a Pennsylvania law that you have to be embalmed, correct? Or is there a way around that now?
There's a way around it. If you do what's called a direct cremation and choose not to have viewing first, you don't have to embalm. You also can do what's called a direct burial. So people still want to be buried, but no public viewing, then you don't have to embalm. So you can actually be buried without being embalmed if you so choose.
Well, I was reading a little bit about green burials, which is a big thing now. People will either get cremated and then mixed with some soil and a tree planted, or they'll be laid out in the woods. I heard there's a couple of places in California that wrap you in a wool blanket and lay you under a tree and just let nature take its course. My friend David was cremated and then cast into a giant piece of cement, which was laid at the bottom of the ocean in a coral reef, and eventually that will become a coral reef. So there's all kinds of new ways for green burials. Do you get many requests for those kind of things?
We've done several. There's one or two areas out in the county that we can work with a green burial, but it's not a real common practice. And that can be a burial without a casket. It can be a burial without a vault. The main reason the cemeteries use a vault, now it's a vault or concrete liner, it's not a state requirement, it's a cemetery requirement. So if you go into an old country cemetery and they've never used them, it's dipping, you're always filling in the dirt, they put the lawnmower over, people walking on it, you know, the ground just can continue to cave in. So that's why that's pretty much the concrete liners have been designed for that. But there are a few country cemeteries that if you really, really, really want it, we're going to find a place to inter it. But not that many people have picked it because they're really not their family cemeteries. They're just kind of a place we found out in the county that would accommodate it. But there are a couple green cemeteries, and they're actually a lot more expensive to bury in than they are the traditional ones because they're building all the long-term maintenance of the land to it and always filling it in and things like that. Yeah.
Well, I remember reading a story about Père Lachaise Cemetery in Paris, and that if you go to Paris, they have the catacombs underneath the cities, which at some point in the 1700s, they went to Père Lachaise Cemetery. They dug up all of the bodies and moved the skeletons underground and stored them in the catacombs beneath Paris. And they had to do that because the ground apparently was incapable of decomposing bodies anymore. It had been so full and so overloaded that they just wouldn't decompose anymore. And so there was a lot of disease and sickness and things like that. So I'm sure a lot of the rules that you have to deal with now are built around preventing disease and sickness. So say you get a body in here who's definitely got some kind of a disease, something we wouldn't want to talk about necessarily, but you have to handle this. Mm-hmm. It's your job no matter what. So how do you deal with a body who comes in with some kind of a major infection that, well, most of us wouldn't want to have to deal with?
Well, the majority of the time, you don't know if a body has a disease or not. So you want to use what we call universal precaution. You want to treat everybody the same because you don't know if this one has
AIDS
HIV,
or
anything.
You don't know what you never know what you're going to have. Right. We don't get a death certificate until, you know, 2-3 days after we've already prepared the body.
Right.
So you treat each body the same and you use universal precaution.
Which is like a hazmat suit,
well,
sort of, give or take?
Yeah, basically, yeah. Mm-hmm. Make you think of it that way. And you treat the bodies the same, too. You disinfect and make sure they're embalmed properly.
So how do you dispose of the body fluids? We always used to think you just flush them down the drain.
And that's what we do.
Really?
Yes.
And that works?
Yes.
Well, and that's good?
Same way as the toilets. You
yeah,
know?
Right.
Yeah, they hopefully disinfect
same
everything
system.
Real well. So
yeah.
Little
so
gross to think of, but yeah, that's
so
the
do you have
way.
To clean that special, like when you're cleaning up the funeral home after it's done, you flushed everything down the,
we
the
use
drain.
We Clorox.
And just Clorox, yeah, just pump it down the drains and off yeah. it goes to the wastewater
little
treatment
elbow
plant.
Grease and yeah, a little disinfectant and elbow grease gets the job done.
So how many bodies, how many sets of remains on average does someone who does embalming have to do a week? Does that vary? Is it like one? Is it 10?
It varies. I mean, we could have a week where we don't have any embalmings and we mm-hmm. could have 5 cremations. And then the next week we could have 10 embalmings and 1 cremation.
And how long does it take to do a whole thing, top to bottom?
On average, it's about an hour to embalm the body.
That's not bad.
Yeah.
I thought that would take 4 or 5 hours.
Yeah.
Or so,
it depends on, because when you get into autopsies or organ donation, those do take longer because there's more to work with.
Right. Has that already been done by the time you get the body?
Yes.
If they're an organ donor, somebody's already come and harvested the organs?
Yes.
And,
mm-hmm.
All right. Then,
yeah, most of the time now the bodies go to Pittsburgh. Mm-hmm. They'll do some of the organ donations with the actual organs like kidneys, livers, and things. They keep them up in Erie until they find the match before they actually take them from the person. But when they get into the skins and the bones and the ligaments and everything involved that way, they'll actually transport to Pittsburgh, do that part of the procedure, and then bring them back up to Erie.
You're listening to Better Than Monkeys from WQLN NPR.
Well, I was told by some friends who mm-hmm. are in the business that you can't be a funeral director or an undertaker without thinking that it's a passion that you should really pursue, that you're doing something good, because it is very involved in so many ways. It's emotional. It's physical. Could be some very late hours. I remember the Gar funeral home, you know, they'd be up at 2, 3, 4 in the morning
oh, yeah.
going out to a site to retrieve a customer or a body to bring
mm-hmm.
them back
yeah.
To the funeral home. So why would you go into the funerary services knowing that it is so involved?
Well, not that I was born into it and always thought I was going to be a funeral director. Fortunately, my dad never said, you know, you're going to come follow me in the business. He never, ever asked me that. So my first job out of college for 5 years is I was a juvenile counselor at a detention center. You know, still living at home, supporting the household because my mom had passed away when I was younger. So one day he just started having a discussion just to say, this is not to push you into it, but if you're ever thinking of getting licensed, now's the time to consider it, because he was starting to have some health issues.
Right.
But, you know, I knew what to expect. And I guess the biggest discussion I had with him is what my responsibilities would be and would they match what my love and interests were. Because I had received a master's in counseling. I enjoyed working with people and just being a part of that. And I didn't want to lose that privilege when I got licensed. And you know, it was just a perfect match and fit for me to do that. And then other people go into it for different reasons. And Barb, why did you pick it, not being raised in it?
No, I never wanted to be a funeral director, never dreamt of it. I was actually in school for nursing. And my brother-in-law's father, Fran Klecker, asked me if I was interested in being a funeral director. And I looked at him and said, no. Why would I want to do that? Now, I wanted to be a nurse, and I wanted to work at nursing homes with the elderly because I always enjoyed the elderly. So he asked me to come work for him that summer, just, you know, help pay for college. And I started working for him that summer, and I switched my major and stuck with it. So
it's not really a dead-end job like everybody
it
says.
Isn't, no.
I heard people are dying to get into the mortuary sciences.
And we're also the last to let you down.
So, literally, 6 feet down.
Yeah, literally.
So you're listening to Better Than Monkeys, a production of WQLN NPR. Have you heard of a funeral home making a huge mistake?
Yes. Fortunately, we haven't yet. And I always say, by the grace of God, go I. But my cousin's husband in Ohio is a claims adjuster for an insurance company, and he ran a case or two by me that came through his insurance program.
So what would that be? Would it be like sending somebody off for cremation who wasn't supposed to be cremated, putting the person in the wrong room with the wrong name? Could be all of the above.
Could be all of the above, and you just pray it's not you. You check and double-check yourself all the time.
Yeah. So how do you make sure you're 100% correct?
Well, we have a lot of hands-on. We mark the bodies. Each body's marked. Each person's tagged along the way in the whole process of it. And you just, you know, make sure that when it's time for the paperwork, there's a lot of conversation in the office. You know, when are you going to be scheduling for the, you know, time of the cremation or burial, things like that. You know, fortunately, I think the worst case that we've ever done, not that we're 100% perfect, is we put the person in the wrong casket. Right. An easy fix, you know, and you still, like I always say, if you make a mistake, you grovel. You know, you just apologize and do the best you can to fix the problem. So fortunately, that's been our worst mistake so far. But things happen. Then you know, there could be a suit or something like that. But I know some of the things are just things that just couldn't be stopped. And I'm not quite sure how all those lawsuits happened in Ohio, but there was a little bit of grace for the funeral director, you know, just trying to do the right thing. But.
So, you know, there's one question everybody wants to know. It's like, you know, when they're all the person is laid out, they're dressed nicely, somebody does their makeup and their hair, everything's in there, and then they cover them with the little blanket and tuck everything in so it all looks prim and proper. Do they wear pants?
Absolutely.
Absolutely?
Yes. Even if you don't bring them in, I put them on them.
Right. So. Anybody ever get buried in their pajamas?
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
That's right. Nigel Arrays and pajamas and...
What about shoes?
Oftentimes shoes.
So, a lot of times shoes? Cause like
they do bring shoes.
Mm-hmm. They do?
Yeah.
So you just tell the family bring a nice suit, something in. And
I always ask them to bring undergarments, their underwear, their, you know, their favorite outfit, what they're most comfortable in.
Because even if they don't, if you tell them to bring the clothing and they don't bring underclothing, we always still provide brand new outfits there because we just feel it's very important to respect the body that way.
So a body could be very heavy. So dressing them, do you have to cut this clothes down the back and then fit them around them while they're already laid out? Or do you actually sit them up and try to get the clothes on?
We only cut if the clothes don't fit. Like if you brought in a suit when dad was, 100 pounds.
Now he's.
Then we would have to cut or we'll call and say, can you bring something bigger in?
Right. We don't standardly cut unless, like she said, it absolutely has to. Right. And then I always have said, like talking to young kids, is like when you're trying to dress person, you're like dressing a very uncooperative baby.
Right.
You know, you pull and you turn and things like that.
Can you do it by yourself or do you always have a helper? Always.
You can do it by yourself. Mm-hmm. When you get the larger bodies, you do. It is nice to have help.
Right. So who do you ask for help?
Not me.
So do you have like people on hand who would help?
Oh, the other funeral directors come down and help.
And we have other full-time staff that are support staff for us that also help. They're very, very supportive along the way.
I remember I used to live over on 14th Street, and the gentleman in the house next door passed away 3 or 4 days before somebody realized he passed away. And apparently it wasn't very pleasant to go get him to take him out of the house. So I would assume it's even less pleasant for a funeral director to have to deal with that when they arrive at the funeral parlor. How often do you have to deal with a situation like that? And how badly does it gross you out, so to speak?
It doesn't really gross you out. I mean, we learn once. I mean, that was the first thing I learned when I started doing removals. Breathe through your mouth, not your nose. So that doesn't get you, because it will get you. I mean, some people have very strong gag reflexes. It gets
It can
them.
Be there, right?
Yeah. But as far as the embalming process, it's still the same process. Once again, like I said, with every body, you do it the same. Breathe through your mouth while you're doing it. It helps a little bit. But
well, they also say, you know, when somebody passes away, the body fills up with gas. So how do you get rid of that gas?
It doesn't usually fill up with gas. There's air that's inside.
Right.
And I mean, sometimes if you move the body, you could hear a little
gasp.
Yeah, something like that.
And if a person was laying there a long time, like, you know, if they pass away during a hot summer day and it's a 24-hour period before they're found, sometimes we're past the point that we can restore them enough to have a public viewing.
Oh, yeah.
Because the body does start breaking down and you do have the gas buildup, but it's just a natural breakdown process. To go back to the smell, I can remember, you know, a good friend, which we both know very well, Murrow Wood, was the coroner for many years, and he never smoked, but he always carried a cigar in his pocket. So when you get into those really tough situations, the cigar comes out and you'll
that
light
or they
it
used
up.
To put the Vicks under,
Vicks
the,
under
nose.
The nose. Yeah, just something
Vicks
to distract you a little
bit. Exactly, yeah.
When I say it's kind of a calling, you know, you could get that call anytime to have to go pick up somebody who's passed away. How much does that interrupt your personal life, or do you schedule for such things? Like, I'm going to be on call tonight. You can be on call tomorrow night, because you probably don't want to get that call during a nice dinner with a spouse or some friends, and suddenly you get the call. It's like, I gotta go pick somebody up.
Yeah.
It's kind of almost like a pecking order. When Barb was first starting
rookies
out.
Rookies first.
Yeah, exactly. When she was first starting out and working with Fran Klecker, she got called away a lot. She'd be
all the time.
You know, nursing her baby and just like, oh, you got a call, you gotta go type thing. But with us, during the day, we send our staff out, the funeral directors, if they have time available. But we're large enough now that we try to get a lot of support staff. So normally, during the night and the evening, there's a lot of great retired men that work for us. That they're the ones that kind of go out for the tough calls at night for us. So it balances out a little bit. You know, but if you're really just a small mom-and-pop thing and you've got to keep it in-house, they would do it. But back in the days when my dad was starting, you know, I can remember my mom would be dressed and they'd be ready to go to a dance and the phone would ring and, sorry, dear, we're not going. And, you know, so she stays home and he goes back to work.
Right.
So, and we have a lot of friends. You know, we have one, you know, getting into the Lenten season. You know, people have their commitments to church and the certain Lenten services they want to go to. Well, we try to balance it out that if there's really an important event that you want to go to, there's other people to step in and back you up.
Right. I do have to share, though, because before I worked for Nancy, I was on call. I had every other weekend off.
Right.
And I had Wednesday was my day off. So with my second child, I was 2 weeks late. He was 10 pounds when he was born, just to let you know how big I was. And I was still working. I wasn't doing removals, but I was still embalming. So the night I was scheduled for a C-section on a Friday, that Thursday night, I got a call 2 o'clock in the morning, and I went in and embalmed the body. And my doctor says, "Did you get enough rest last night?" I said, "Oh, yeah, average." So your body, you get used to it, you know, as far as waking up. I mean, I could be up nursing my baby, getting a death call. You learn to cope with it, and hopefully you have a spouse who's willing to work along with you with that. Or else it could be difficult, but
yeah. Well, the smell is pretty regular too. Like if you're pregnant, a lot of times you can be much more sensitive to smells.
Yes.
You know, so I'm assuming that it's probably not real easy as you get into your 9th month to also.
No,
still
well,
be
you
doing
I had to wear a respirator anyway to keep the chemicals out. So you didn't even smell while you were in the prep room. Right. Now, going on removals, because I would go up till about 5 or 6 months when people were like uncomfortable with me being there picking up their loved ones. And I remember walking into a house, it was just, there was litter boxes everywhere. And the ammonia, I said, okay, I'll be right back. You know, I had to go outside. It was just such a strong odor that it got me where normally it wouldn't have. But
Nancy Duskus and Barbara Terizzi from Duskus Funeral Homes are our special guests today on Better Than Monkeys. I'm Brian Hanna. And today we're exploring the world of mortuary sciences.
You have to do reconstruction from time to time, right?
Mm-hmm.
So maybe there was an accident or somebody comes in. How do you deal with that? Like if there's a lot of damage. I know makeup can cover a wealth of damages, but say somebody comes in and they're pretty damaged, but not damaged enough that you don't want to do an open casket. Because I assume goal one is to give people an opportunity to say goodbye to their loved one. So when it comes down to doing reconstruction, how much do you have to do of that? Do you have to rebuild cheekbones and rebuild skin?
We've rebuilt ears and things before. We've had a young man years ago that was killed in an accident, and his ear was severed. And one of my staff took the whole day, and that's one of the things you learn in mortuary school is just
reconstructive art's one of your subjects.
Mm-hmm. Reconstructive art.
Yeah, so he actually rebuilt the ear out of wax and connected it, and the family never knew the extent of the damage that was done by that. But there's some, you know, the hardest thing is if they're in an accident and they're A lot of broken bones in the facial areas. Those are real difficult to fix. You try to do the best you can. Sometimes one side's a little bit more damaged than the other, so we'll reverse them in the casket so that you're really seeing the better side, even though there's a little bit of damage, you know, on the side that's against the back panel.
When it comes to reconstruction, are you inside working on this reconstruction,
wax,
or is it completely just wax,
wax,
rebuild and color and everything like that, so you don't have to get gooey or do anything?
I mean, if they have a it's an autopsy or they have a lot of cranial damage, you know, they'll go ahead and we'll try to build it with maybe a plaster Paris type thing. We've done that before. Yeah, if there's an autopsy, because sometimes we don't get all the organs back if there's an autopsy. It depends what the coroner's looking for. So you try to even mask some of those things, too, that have been done by autopsies.
So what kind of tools do you use to do these things? Is it literally just clay, plaster of Paris, a little bit of wax, whatever you can, whatever's?
Yeah, they have, it's a mortuary type,
grade,
which
right.
adheres better to the tissue. And once again, the purpose of embalming to dry out so it adheres better to the surface.
Actually, a lot of what they use or we use for embalming are things that have been developed even in the 1800s. We have what they call a little cannula hook, which attaches to the vessels that attach to a tubing in the embalming machine. And that was developed in the 1800s, and you can't really improve on it at all. So some of the tools are just tried and true, and you just kind of, you know, work with what's been developed and work well over the years.
Well, you know, I found a website that was children asking questions of morticians. And some of these questions from children can be pretty brutal.
Yes.
And I'll just read some. We don't have to answer them all.
Oh.
What do you do with the murders? The next question was, why does decomposition cause you to change crazy colors? Another was, how soon will my eyeballs decompose? Will my cat eat my eyeballs? Do babies die? That's a reasonable question.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And have you ever tasted a dead human body?
So,
so we're going to start with number six. Have you ever tasted a dead human body?
Absolutely
now, I'm assuming
not.
You haven't like licked one or something like that, you know, there's accidents happen. You know, you forget you've been working on somebody, you reach up and rub your nose.
Yeah.
I'm sure it happens from time to time.
Yeah, you might actually stab yourself accidentally with a needle when you're doing some work or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm sure there's processes involved to mitigate all of that.
Correct.
But what's the worst story you've heard for that? Have you heard of
Well, the saddest one, a couple of sad ones, is when a person has died in their house and no one's knew it, and they have a dog there.
Mm-hmm.
And the dog has actually, you know, didn't totally eat the person, but they've chewed up some of the parts of the face and things like
right.
that because
So
of,
the cat could eat your eyeballs.
Yeah.
If you let them.
Is the cat more likely to be, because cats don't care. They have no souls. Dogs, you know. So,
yeah.
So who's more likely to eat you when you've passed away, your dog or your cat?
Your dog.
Your dog for sure?
Yeah. Sadly, we've seen a couple cases like that. Not that they eat them all up, but enough damage that we haven't been able to have a viewing.
Aw,
yeah.
See, that's why you got to make sure the dog is sleeping in a different room.
That's right.
We already talked about eyeballs. How soon do they decompose?
Mm-hmm.
Pretty quickly because they're relatively fluid-filled.
Mm-hmm.
Why does decomposition cause you to change crazy colors?
That's just a science question. You know, that's just part of nature. And it just, you know, purple is probably the main color that we see. A lot of people, the one thing that they don't realize, like, and one of the things that's hard when we try to embalm and we try to, we call flush out and get back to the normal color. If a person has been deceased and laying on their face a long time, blood settles to the lower part of the body in the extremity. And if you find them fairly quickly, you can what we call flush out or clean it out. But if the person's been laying there for a day, then sometimes the tissues can be stained and we can't always get them out. But that doesn't mean we can't have viewing. We just mask it more with cosmetics.
With more cosmetics.
Yeah.
So do you do all your own makeup work or do you have somebody who comes in
we
and specializes
it?
No. All
funeral house? Directors are trained to learn to do that.
Yeah.
So you can
yeah.
do hair and all that other stuff?
We can. Mm-hmm. It doesn't always look the best, but yeah.
So we do bring a hairdresser.
We have hairdressers
in.
Come in. Yeah.
Well, I do have a friend who does that
yes.
kind of work.
Yes.
So,
Cindy Johnson.
Cindy Johnson.
Yeah.
So,
yes.
So we do know that there are
Now, we would do your hair.
Mine would be easy.
Yeah. Yours would be easy.
If you're listening at home, I have none.
Yeah.
Speaking of, have you had people come in and say, oh, my God, that looks nothing like a relative. I'm so unhappy. And what do you do?
Your heart drops.
I know you try your best. You have pictures
yes. yeah.
and the like, but
yeah.
but sometimes it's got to be difficult.
Yeah.
How do you recover from somebody saying something like that?
What I do is normally ask them about the length of sickness, because a lot of times they come out of the hospital and because of the resuscitation they've been trying to do with the person, they they have a swelling to the bodies or things like that. So that's where you have most of the complaints, is if the person's been really sick and that part of the dying process has changed them. And there's really not a lot that you can do to reverse them. Fortunately, it doesn't happen a lot, but every funeral home is going to get that comment, you know, if they're honest with you on it.
You've got a funeral going on. Something terrible has happened. Either there was a divorce or an argument something. And people are already grieving, but they're still angry, and they're going to bring that to the funeral home. And you could have family fights. You could have arguments. Do you have people who start a scuffle in the funeral home? Do you have people who are just so angry at the dead body that they come in and scream at the deceased? What kind of interesting dynamics have you had to encounter as funeral directors?
All of them.
All of the
above. Yeah. Spouses, you know, girlfriend, boyfriend. I mean, you name it, they come through the doors, and death usually brings out the worst.
We had one situation I remember that they were different religions, and we actually resolved it by having two different funeral services, so they each can have their own need. We had a couple, sadly, they were both in the same year, and every time something like that happens, you call your funeral director association in Harrisburg's attorney and said, okay, give me some advice.
Right.
And I had a couple families that could not agree. They agreed on cremation, but they could not agree on the disposition after the cremation. And one of the things we are not allowed to do is to hold cremains hostage. So once a funeral is done, even if you walk away and never pay us, we cannot hold cremains hostage. And I said to my director, the attorney, I said, what do we do? And she says, hold the cremains hostage. So she told me that, number one, to do that. We tried working it out again. We could not work it out. There were seven kids in the family. So her advice was split the cremains seven ways, and everyone comes in and signs for their little part of it. So you get some tough family dynamics that you have to work through. But one of the fun ones my dad had told me years ago is he had a case where the gentleman had a couple wives and girlfriends and things like that, and they were arguing like whose car was going to be number one in the procession. So finally, my dad, they couldn't agree, and my dad just said, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to go out and hire a city bus. Everybody gets on the bus together, and you all be there at the same time. And then they really realized they were then being silly. So sometimes you just really counsel and just kind of see if you can agree to disagree somehow, but sometimes you just can't.
What do you do if somebody's got nobody? Nobody knows who they are. Does the city just call and say, we're going to need you to take care of this one pro bono, or?
It goes to the coroner's office. And if it's a totally unclaimed person, then the coroner takes it over as an unclaimed body. Interesting enough, though, that if that person is in a nursing home, the coroner does not consider it an unclaimed body. That nursing home has to take some responsibility because they have that person in there as a resident. So that's where you start negotiating with a nursing home as to what they want to do or should do. But you really got to be careful and sit on those things. And we make a lot of phone calls because there have been a few situations where we've been told there's nobody. Get a call from the nursing home, help us out. And we check and double check and ask questions. And oftentimes someone surfaces.
Yeah. Right. How often does somebody die? They get cremated. Loved one takes possession of the cremains, as you call them. And then that person passes away, and there's nowhere for the cremains to go. So what do they do?
What do we have on our shelf now?
Well, we just got a phone call less than a month ago. Someone was in their U-Haul storage locker that they just purchased, and they found so-and-so's cremains, but our name was on it. I said, bring them in to us, and we'll reach out to the family. We're still trying to reach out to the family, but more and more with cremation, you're going to run into that. I mean, people buy keepsakes or necklaces, and there's no names on them. They lose them. Or they leave them at their apartment when they move from one place to another.
So what do you do with them,
sir? We inter them. If we write letters to the families if they've never been claimed and send them out certified to make sure we have a record. And if they don't, we actually go up to South Harbor Creek United Methodist Church Cemetery. And we have a working relationship with them, and we inter the cremains there. So if someone does come back later on, we know the spot and the grave, and we can bring them up and return them back to them.
Are they put in a little vault like a casket would be so that they stay relatively well-preserved?
They're all in their own individual containers in a baby casket so that they're maybe 12, but individually wrapped, individually packaged. And then so the crypt one, crypt two, crypt three, and then if we have to, we can bring them up, which we've done one time. We did that once, I think.
How long does it take to cremate a body?
Three, 4 hours by the time the heat goes up and the body cools back down.
Now, it could be misinformation, just something somebody told me. So, once they go into the crematorium, you bring them out, and apparently sometimes they still are shaped like a human body. And then I heard that you have to roll them with a granite roller to make it actually dust. So how much of that is true?
Well, I don't know if it's a granite roller, but they
they do have to pulverize the bone because they are, I mean, it doesn't make them dust, the crematory itself.
The large bones are still recognizable. Yeah. Small bones may not be. Large bones are still recognizable. Right. So the machine does break them down into the dust.
The machine
portion.
Does that for
the
you?
The machine does it.
Now, I also heard there's a new machine that liquefies the body and that they can mix it into compost. Have you heard about this?
Is it something that's real? Well, it's out there, but no one in Erie is doing it.
Thank goodness, because it just sounds creepy. Yeah. But who wants to necessarily be composted?
Yeah, I mean, you can send your cremains up to space now if you want.
Have yourself made into a coral reef.
Yeah. The main thing we try to, when we talk to people, is to try to realize it's a loved one out of respect.
Was my next question, how do you maintain respect when maybe the loved ones are looking for just something fun or quirky?
Well, fortunately, we're not too crazy fun or quirky yet in Erie, maybe because it's more of a conservative town. But, you know, there's advertising for all that out there. You know, take your cremains, make them into a diamond, you know, things like that. But you want to respect the person, you know, the loved one. Yes, cremation is considered the final act of disposition. So once that happens, the state doesn't care what you do. But if you choose to bury the cremains, you have to go under the cemetery regulations. And then from that point, if you want to scatter, if you want to do something quirky, the state's not going to stop you.
Are there regulations? I know once you've got possession of the remains, you can pretty much run under the radar. But are there state guidelines as to how to spread ashes or places you're allowed? Or is it just do what you do?
I always say don't put them where, like, if your neighbor really hates you, don't put them in your neighbor's yard. But other than that, Pennsylvania doesn't have any regulations.
They don't have regulations.
At this point.
People may frown upon you about taking dad out to the golf course, you know, if they come see you doing that. Or they'll frown upon it, the golf course, or even other people out there golfing. But it's...
Do you counsel them on that? It's like, hey, we just want to spread dad's remains on the golf course.
We tell them to do it discreetly. Well, no, we don't even say call. We just do it very discreetly. I've gone out and actually spread them in the woods by golf courses. Back a few years ago, when you remember those little ladybug things were coming out, they weren't ladybugs, but they were
they were all over.
I went to a golf course and went out into the woods. So they wanted to be by their favorite hole, but I did not want to do it by the hole. So I said, I'm going to do it near the hole in the woods. And I came back out of the woods and I had this stuff, all these bugs all over me. So, you know, we counsel them just to do it discreetly, very discreetly.
You're listening to Better Than Monkeys, a production of WQLN NPR. When you cremate a body, a lot of times now there's parts. There's hips, joints, elbows,
metal parts
all over the place. What do you do with those? You don't have to take them out pre-cremation, I would assume.
They just get recycled a lot, just to a metal place. You know, nothing fancy at all. If a person wants one of those back, if they want their pacemaker back, anything like that, we will return them. But for the most part, people don't want them back.
Right. So I don't know how you.
They trust us just to take care of it.
Hip. You never know.
You never know. That's right.
So, what is the strangest thing that has ever happened to you as a funeral director?
Go ahead. You go first.
I have to think about that a little bit.
You can, because I can edit out dead space.
Okay, you're going to have to, because I'm going to have to think about this.
Well, you have to define strange, I guess.
Well, you can define strange, because my definition of strange and this definition of strange to a funeral director could be two completely separate things.
Well, my strange was just thinking there was a ghost in the building. Yeah. I mean, other than that, you know, the time when I was talking about, you know, hearing those people sobbing, I thought the body was sobbing. That to me was kind of strange as a person. And I was an adult when that happened. But other than that, you know, just we're so not so much we're used to it, but just as a part of life. And you just try not to have this part of the journey of life scare you. So you just kind of work with the situations, work with the families, and just adapt to it.
Well, the business of death has to be a little tough, too. So you're working with families who are distraught or angry or any of the above. What kind of emotional toll does that take on you as a funeral director, dealing day in and day out? It's a 7-day-a-week thing. You don't ever get to walk away from it. Even if you go on vacation, you're coming right back to it. So how do you deal with the day in, day out business of death without letting it bring you down?
For me, it's prayer. When I'm working on the bodies, when I'm working with the families, I mean, luckily I have a good, strong faith, and that's what gets me through taking care of a 6-month-old baby or someone's grandfather who died the same age as my grandfather, same circumstances. You know, you get pulled right into there, and it takes you back to a loss of someone in your life. So, I mean, prayer is what gets me through the hardest of times.
Mm-hmm. And I'm the same way. You know, I just really have been thankful that my parents raised me with a faith walk, and that they taught us right from the beginning how to respect the people. I mean, I was sitting as a child in the living room, and my dad would get a phone call from someone, the husband on the other line, on the other side, was going to commit suicide. And while my dad was on the phone with a wife, he did commit suicide right in front of her. So you kind of grow up with that, but the faith walk and just really knowing that that part of your life is something that you just really try to accept and work with, and just realize you're there just to really work with the families. Our hearts break when we see a young person die. You see someone who's leaving kids behind. You see young couples just grieve terribly, or a parent grieve when their child dies. And you're there more for the families. You want to respect the person that passed away and do everything you can to give them the respect that's due. But your heart's really with the people as you're going through it. And that's where you just really, you know, you use your faith, you use your family, you use your friends. I always say the three F's: faith, family, and friends. And you lean on those and you talk about it. Barb's husband's a funeral director too. And so, you know, she has someone that she can lean on there.
That understands.
Understands. Her kids aren't afraid of the journey. So, you know, I'm sure she's had conversations with them. And
they've been more than they want.
Yeah. Yeah. So when you kind of balance it all out, you cannot do it alone.
Right.
And you just really lean on all of them. You know, we talk amongst ourselves, but we talk with our family, we talk with our friends, and you know, there's a confidentiality that's there, which is very important, but they let you talk about the tough times too, right, when something's really bothering you.
So how about family or friends? Could you, as a funeral director, work on somebody who was a family or friend, and have you? Or do you call upon friends in the business to take care of that for you? Because I know if I was an employee or owned a funeral home, that's where I would want my final moment to be. So what do you do in that situation?
Me, I'm the type of funeral director that wants to do it for, like, my father just passed away almost a year ago. And everyone says, who's going to do his body? I said, well, I am. That's my last thing I can do for him.
Right.
I know it's not him anymore. And my father he had cancer, so he didn't look like himself.
Right.
So I thought, I have to do this, not just for me, but for my family, so they could say goodbye to him one more time. Right. Now, was it easy? No, I cried half the time I was there. You know, I was bawling and I was talking to him, knowing that it's not him. But I still wanted to do that for my father. And I've done my coworkers that I've worked with, friends and relatives, just because for me, it's the last thing I can do for them.
Right.
A lot of people,
that's your gift. It's your
yeah. Right. A lot of people don't want to do it, mm-hmm. and they look at me like, "How could you do that?" But that's my perspective.
Right.
So
now for me, like, my training is not as strong, even though I'm as licensed and certified as Barb is. Most of my responsibilities have been with the families and the arranging and doing the business part of it. So I'm not as talented in the sense of all the prep work or cosmetics. So I was in a little different situation because that's not my strong suit.
Right.
I let my staff do it when my dad passed away. And then I actually did not see him until he was in the casket and ready for viewing. So there's different ways, and you use your talents and your strengths for that particular part of it. When my dad passed away, I just sat in back like a person just grieving. I did not get involved in the funeral service at all. I let my staff handle it. But you had mentioned your friends, the Gars. You know, we had gone to their funeral when their dad passed away.
Right.
And the boys that were licensed were actually running the funeral and pushing the casket and stuff. So everyone kind of deals with it in their own way. You know, I'm a little different because I'm a larger funeral home. So I know my staff and I trust them along the way. But when you get into, you know, you're very hands-on in some of those areas of your life daily, then you do feel very comfortable saying, hey, I'm the one that's going to make sure mm-hmm. that it's where, you know, he's where I want to be.
You know, and so many of the funeral homes and the families that run them in the Erie area are such mainstays. You know, mm-hmm. of course, you mentioned Duskus and Klecker, and there's the Gars and Tad Bowers out in Northeast mm-hmm. and Elkins, Bill Elkins.
We're fortunate to have Aaron Bowers working with us now, too.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
They're just wonderful people, mm-hmm. wonderful families. It does tend to become a family business.
Mm-hmm.
Now, why is that? Do you think it's just because you're so comfortable growing up in the family that you're like, no, I'll just keep doing it too?
I think that has a lot to do because I didn't grow up in it, never wanted to do it. But my sister is married to Mark Klecker. And he has two children, Adrian and Francis, who are also funeral directors now. Right. And they learned alongside me while I was working there. So it was, they saw Aunt Barbara doing it. They wanted to do it. You know what I mean? It was, right. It made them even want to do it even more.
Right.
But see, my dad was first generation. So he did not have anybody that he came up along beside to do that. He lost his father when he was only 17, and there was younger siblings in the family. And it was one of those journeys that he really felt a passion to be a funeral director. You know, he could have been a doctor. He knew enough, and he had an older and younger brother that were doctors. But he never had an interest. He wanted to always be a funeral director. And so he trained under people out of Edinburgh first, and then it was in Pittsburgh before he went to World War II and then came back up to Erie. So, you know, he just had that heart. And so me seeing him with it, I think the hardest thing I had for a decision to become a funeral director was not so much the work and the things I was going to involved in, but the commitment to stay in Erie.
Right.
You know, I have other friends, you know, they've like, oh, we're going to go to Florida, or we're going to go to Arizona, or go someplace. They can take the job and career
anywhere
to go.
Mm-hmm.
But once you commit to a family-owned funeral home, you're committed to Erie. Not that I had any intention to go anywhere, but I had to accept the fact that if I did, I'm committing myself to Erie.
I'd assume a lot of times, you know, even though it might be a family business, there's family members who want nothing to do with the family business. They want to go on and try something else.
Look at Gars. There's 12 kids in the family, and none of them are in the business anymore.
Right.
So
exactly.
It's, you know.
So how does that carry on? Like, say at a certain point, somebody does not want to be in the family business. You're the last person in the family. But that business has been in town for hundreds of years. Do you sell the business and the name, or does it just stop operating a little?
Most of the time you sell the business and the name, and hopefully the staff that are on board that are very committed and have been with you 10, 15, 20 years are the ones to pick up the gauntlet and keep on going, because they know us. Our friends and staff know them. The families and the community have gotten to know them, so hopefully they carry it the next generation.
Just carry it on. Are there any stipulations with disposing of a body who had something terrible? We know we talked about having to embalm somebody who might have HIV or V or something. Say a body came in and it had Ebola or HIV. Do you have to do anything different in the disposal of that body, or is it just straightforward in a casket, in a vault, and in the ground, and it's good to go?
Exactly.
Yep. Straightforward.
It's pretty straightforward.
Yeah.
You would think it would be like wrap them in plastic,
seal them
in glass,
that's
put them in.
That's right now with the coronavirus. What are you going to do? I said, well, the same thing you do with anyone.
Yeah.
You have to treat them all the same. And
you're not going to catch coronavirus from a person who's passed away.
Right. It'll have died by then.
Yeah. You're going to catch it from people who come in that have it. We've actually had a disease that's really does not die in a sense. Like coronavirus eventually, the host will die, the bacteria. But there's a disease called a CJD disease. And the very first time 20 years ago when we saw one, the coroner actually talked the family into doing an immediate burial without embalming or anything, because they did not know a lot about it. We had one. We weren't sure if that was the disease or not. It wasn't actually confirmed, but we treated it as a such. So there was an embalmer who was very comfortable working in cases like that, who did the prep work. And we just told the families, you know, we wore gloves, we wore protection, and we just told the families, don't kiss them, don't hug them, and just... When we ever moved him, we were protective along the way too. But he ended up being embalmed and buried. Yeah.
So who oversees the operation of funeral homes? You know, the Board of Health obviously oversees restaurants. So who oversees funeral homes?
State Board of Funeral Directors.
Oh, okay.
In Pennsylvania.
Are you run by other? Is it like an association of funeral directors who kind of all just oversee the operation of the field, or is there an actual government entity?
Pennsylvania State Board of Funeral Directors gives us our license, just as they would for, and they come in and they inspect us, make sure that we meet all the requirements that way. But then also our billing part of it, like we have to present to a family our costs, our overhead, things like that, and that comes under the Federal Trade Commission law.
Right.
So Federal Trade Commission has mandated how we present our costs and what the breakdown is.
Speaking of costs, say I'm broke, I die, nobody wants to pay for it. What happens?
Call the neighbor down the street. No, not really. We all step up. We get a call from a coroner that there's a family here, and you know, we don't do it with an unclaimed body.
Right.
But if there's family that can say, hey, you know, we want to be there, but we've got nothing. most every funeral director will try to work with that need and respectfully try to get things done.
Is there government funding for that kind of stuff?
Only if they're under welfare. An actual welfare recipient, then the welfare program gives you $750. Other than that, there's absolutely nothing.
Is that enough?
No. Not by the time you even just pay the crematory, combustible unit, and removal. You know, we get nothing. There are some wonderful programs out there if there's a family that really wants to bury and they don't have anything. Some of the community programs will step up and give enough at least to buy a grave openings. The cemeteries will step up and do their part. So it's like everybody, the cemeteries, the community, and the funeral homes all pitch in, and there's a sacrifice made by everybody to get the person interred if they want it.
Well, you know, you hear about it from the 1700s and 1800s all the time, a pauper's grave, buried in a pauper's grave. There is no more pauper's grave, is there?
Only when it's an unclaimed person cremated by the coroner's office, he'll go out and scatter the cremains out in the county at a cemetery.
And there is a designated place for that.
That he has, so. Correct. Right.
So I think I remember the story mostly correctly that my grandfather was cutting through his cemetery on the way home, my great-grandfather, so it was probably early 1900s. And as he was cutting through the cemetery, his foot went way down in a hole, and apparently he could jump straight up in the air from having his foot fall in a hole. What are the odds of something like that happening to you if you're wandering through a cemetery these days? Pretty slim?
Pretty slim with a vault,
yeah.
But only if you're an old country cemetery. I've actually stepped into a cremation grave, shocked me and shocked the family in front of me. But we was out in the county, and the caretaker was not there. He opened up the cremation grave, and he put a very thin piece of white styrofoam over the grave. So not even a board, but very thin piece of white styrofoam, and then it snowed.
Oh.
So we're out there trying to find the grave, and I happened to step right on that thin piece of white styrofoam, and boom, right down I went.
So how fast did you come out of the hole?
Pretty quick. Yes.
So have you had anybody come back to life?
Not yet.
No?
Not yet.
No, they never brought a body in, and they aren't quite gone yet?
Not yet. Well, hopefully that the nurses and the hospice workers, and we were talking about that before, and hopefully people have done their job well. But, I mean, it's on the news. You've read about somebody being at a funeral home, and they pop up.
Well, that's where the term dead ringer comes from. I guess back in the early days, they would run a bell from the tombstone down into the casket. So if you woke up in the casket, you could ring it. Mm-hmm. But today we have embalming and preparation in the old days.
And time involvement. We cannot do a cremation right away. You know, we have to wait at least 24 hours. But by the time you get the death certificates, by the time you get the coroner to sign off and everything that's involved in that, there's a couple
pretty
of days.
Pretty sure that it's not going to happen. Because that's one of the things that worries me. I've got a little claustrophobia. I just don't want to end up waking up someplace I shouldn't be. So I don't have to worry about that.
Exactly.
No. If I get to that point, it's probably I'm long gone.
Exactly.
That's good to know.
Yeah.
So what do you, as funeral directors, think that people should know about the entire process? What is something that we don't really think about on a day-to-day basis that people really should know about the funeral process?
My only thought, I'll go back to my counseling background, is what's best for the family. You're leaving the loved ones behind. You want them to grieve well. And so as we go through the process, we want to make sure that the decisions that are made are going to help you grieve well down the road. So for me, it's just making sure that we talk through all the options, make sure that we're doing what's best for the family, and not cutting any corners for them if they're really having a struggle and letting go. So it's how do you grieve well for the families is my main concern.
What about you, Barbara? What would you think?
Just make sure your loved ones know what you want when you die. It'd make life a lot easier for us and also for your loved ones. Because there's so many times they come in and go, I don't know.
Well, that could be as simple as just writing it down, right? You don't have to like do some big long legal document.
No, just let them know. I want cremation, or I want burial, I want a funeral, or I don't care what you do with me.
Right.
But that really pays a toll on those families when it's something sudden, and they have absolutely no idea what to do.
Again, that comes back to our very first thing, which is pre-planning.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great idea. Does pre-planning cost? Do you have to like pay up front to pre-plan, or can you make all of the arrangements and then you pay for it when it happens?
Correct. You can pay for it later. You can use life insurance. You can have an estate, maybe, if your house is going to be sold. So you can pre-plan, but you do not have to prepay.
And do you guys help with that? Does the funeral home help with that? Could I walk in tomorrow and go, you know, my parents are in their 70s. Let's go ahead and get this ironed out so that we don't have to worry about it 20 years from now.
Absolutely. Yes. That's a big part of our responsibilities. Mm-hmm.
It is. So how do people get in touch with you if they want to talk to either of you about
pre-planning? Well, Jeff, you just call the funeral home at 899-7656, and we'll be glad to sit down with you. And just, again, there's no commitment. You can ask questions. If you just want material sent out to you without even meeting us face-to-face, we got a lot of good material to send out. So just to talk does not commit. But one of the things we really enjoy doing is educating. So right. If we can educate and not put any pressure on the family to make a commitment, we're glad to do that also.
And just one last question. I can fit it in somewhere else in the middle. You ever have to ship a body, and how do you do it?
Yes.
Yes. The body, for the most part, has to be embalmed. Now, we've gotten a couple cases where we've had Orthodox background or Jewish background, and they do not want to be embalmed. So if they're shipping within the United States, we use cold packs and we get the body temperature down to be able to ship. But if it's going overseas, we had a case years ago, sadly, a young Muslim gentleman was killed in a car accident, Edinburgh student, and they don't embalm, they bury immediately. But his family over in Russia that were Muslim wanted him back. And 10:30 at night, Jack Martin and I were calling the consulate and saying, what do we do? You know, the Erie community does not want him embalmed. And the consulate Muslim said, you embalm him and you get him on a plane. Because in that faith walk, there are, you know, if there's extenuating circumstances, then you can make some wise judgment type things. Right. So most of the time a person's embalmed, casketed, shipped out or shipped into us. But if it's a religious concern, an orthodoxy type thing, if it's done in the United States and you just get them to our airport and, you know, get them where they're going within the same day, then we can use cold packs.
Is that a commercial flight?
Cargo.
Yes. Oh, in the cargo.
Yeah, just right in the cargo all your luggage. So it could be down there. It could be a dog or a cat in a crate. You could have all your luggage down there. And there could be somebody right underneath you.
Yep. Exactly.
So who knows that that's on the plane besides the baggage handlers? Are the pilots aware that there's a special cargo?
Probably not. It goes to the cargo department.
Yeah.
We don't pick the person up at the terminal. We go to the cargo section.
Right. So it's right on the plane.
Yeah. The only time they would really know probably is if it's a veteran.
Because then they make special arrangements for something like that.
Yeah.
And again, there's another big thing there. Say you're a veteran. We've got so many veterans in this country right now. What kind of special arrangements do people make for that? You know, a lot of times you go to this cemetery and there's actually somebody plays taps and you'll have an honor guard. Is that something as simple as calling a VFW and saying, we've got a vet and he's going to need some arrangements?
They step up to the plate all the time. They're fantastic. Mm-hmm.
That's really wonderful.
Yeah, they're willing to do that, and they'll never say no.
So there's a lot of actual joy, probably, though, in being a funeral director, even though you might not see it, because you're helping these families grieve, get through a really tough time. Do you build emotional bonds with these families, or are they in and out so fast that you don't really get time to?
I think you do build a lot of bonds with them. Not where I am now, because I haven't been with Nancy that long, but where I was before, the families would be coming back, and, you know, you're pregnant again? You know what I mean?
Right.
Joking with you like it's one of your relatives. But you do get a nice bond with the families. You go to their houses, bring them their register book, death certificates, things like that.
Right.
Just have conversation with them, make sure they're doing okay, and see if they need help following up with anything. And
it's a very personal profession.
Yeah.
I had a situation where the family that sadly within a couple of years, they lost three members of the family. And they got to know me so well that I got invited to their family Christmas parties.
Oh.
So for a couple of years, I would go to the family Christmas parties. I'd get gifts from Santa Claus, everything like that. So you do really build an emotional bond with a lot of them.
So really what we can take away from here is, sure, there are some uncomfortable things that go along with being a funeral director, the embalming and recovery of a person's body, things like that. But there are a lot of wonderful things that go along with being a funeral director, too. And
absolutely,
people just need to understand that it's not the Addams Family. It's
right.
It's not a creepy situation. Funeral
Which
homes,
my kids want to be the Addams Family.
They would love that,
yes,
I'm sure.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
People, but when they grow up.
Yeah. People that are involved in it just really know the time commitment, too. I mean, they work weekends, they work holidays. I've chosen not to use an answering service, so I answer the phone in the middle of the night. And it's like, Nancy, you sound wide awake. Well, you know, you
get used to it.
You get used to it, but you want to do it for the families. You want to just be on task and ready to meet their needs, you know. And so it's It's a joy to be able to serve. It really is.
Well, thanks for peeling back the curtain, so to speak, on mortuary sciences and the art of running a funeral home. Thanks, Cindy Johnson. Making sure that contact could happen. But again, Duskus Funeral Home, it's Barb and Nancy coming in and talking with us on Better Than Monkeys. You are listening to Better Than Monkeys. It's a production of WQLN NPR. Thank you both so much for coming in and spending some time
with
us here.
Thank you. It's been fun.
Wow, I learned so much on today's episode of Better Than Monkeys, things about the funeral business I'd never heard before. I hope you learned something too, thanks to our friends Nancy Duskus and Barbara Terizzi of Duskus Funeral Homes for joining us for this episode of Better Than Monkeys. And if you'd like more information and to check out more episodes of Better Than Monkeys, well, you can find it by visiting WQLN on the web at wqln.org/BTM. I'm Brian Hanna. Thanks again for joining me for Better Than Monkeys.
I didn't get to tell you about the blue pill, though.
The what?
The question about how you make the body so stiff.
Oh, no. Good.
Put a little blue pill.